Welcome back, Masters of the Multi-Usiverse. My name is Gar Punnett, Chief Impact Officer here at Reaply. Another great conversation coming forward to you today with Heidi Frazier, Sustainability Manager at Steelcase, an office furniture manufacturer located in Michigan, but footprint globally. They are absolutely a leader in this space and provide probably something you're sitting in right now or something you sit in at the office. We got to talk about sustainability work, her origins in the sustainability and circular economy space, more extended producer responsibility initiatives, and again, more programs to come from either Europe or the United States, and then also what we get to expect when we're talking about more product circularity. There's more work for future generations to come and more work for us to talk about. But again, here's the podcast. Enjoy. Heidi, thanks for joining us. We've got Heidi Frazier here from Steelcase, Sustainability Manager at Steelcase, one of the leaders in office furniture manufacturing. So excited to have you. Thanks for joining to talk about circularity and sustainability. How did you get involved with sustainability and circularity? And then how did you get your start and involvement at Steelcase?
Yeah, so thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here. My background really is kind of weird. I got my start in environmental compliance. My background is actually watershed science and stewardship. So kind of hit the ground running, working for the Department of Energy, doing nuclear waste site cleanup. So it was a little funky. I don't glow, but had a lot of experience doing actual cleanup efforts. So saw firsthand what happens when organizations, including our government, don't manage waste properly and don't actually, have sustainable efforts. So got my start there and then kind of moved on through the industry on consulting terms. So worked on a huge oil spill cleanup project on the Kalamazoo River here in Michigan. Similar concept of dealing with different regulatory entities, and sometimes they don't always get along. So that was really interesting. We could do a whole podcast on that. And then kind of jumped into like the manufacturing side of things. So I did some internal auditing with a company called Intertech out of Grand Rapids, and saw how things were made from like behind the scenes. And that was really cool and kind of started really evolving and growing from there in the sustainability world. I've been with Steelcase for 5 years and really excited about kind of changing from within, especially with corporations. I think we always kind of want to make a difference, and I volunteer a lot on the side, but I really think the difference comes from within organizations. And so that's kind of where my passions are driven. I also fly fish and do a lot of outdoor activities. So keeping the environment clean is a huge passion of mine in general.
Well, that maybe speaks to the passion for the river systems as well. I want to take a step back actually into something you talked about with the regulatory efforts. Can you actually speak about that a little bit in terms of the experience you saw on either different departments trying to figure out where they fit and who is trying to lead what type of effort? How does that play into manufacturers in general, in your opinion? I think that's always an interest for our audience on how does the business landscape maybe interact with the compliance and regulatory landscape? What have you seen from your experience in that?
Yeah, I would say it's ever evolving and kind of patchwork and difficult to stay ahead of. So right now, I mean, from a circular economy perspective, I think there's a ton going on in that space, especially in Europe. And I think there's a lot of efforts being put forth around extended producer responsibility laws and what companies do with their products after they're placed on the market. Like, where does that ownership start and stop, and how much ownership should they have over end of life treatment and management of their products? So I think that's ever evolving. We're seeing it pop up here in the States too. Now, you know, Maine, Oregon, bunch of packaging, extended producer responsibility laws coming out. And I think furniture is definitely on a lot of radars from that perspective. So it's something we're definitely keeping an eye on. It's interesting. I think it pushes industries in directions, yep. Sometimes positive, sometimes not so positive, because I think it can be really confusing. Like I said, it's patchwork. So in Europe, especially, we tried to have a integrated and aligned system through the EU, but unfortunately, that's not really how it played out. So the extended producer responsibility laws there are really confusing. And in some cases, not always going towards actually funding recycling of the products, which is what the whole point of them was. So I think there's a lot to be said for like learning lessons learned on what was done right, what was done wrong. And I'm hoping that the states and Canada kind of take a note from that rather than trying to like repeat what they're doing and continuously doing the wrong thing. So yeah, I think it's pushing industries in different directions.
I think that's fascinating. Where again, there's a continual, there's a reaction, re-reaction from a government and business standpoint that is just again ever evolving. To your point, I could have phrased this negatively, and I'm going to try not to. We in the States kind of can go back and forth with how the business community views the government community, and always the reaction. And I'm typically I'm fairly pro some sort of regulations when it comes to the environment, but also understand the consequences that has on growing business and understanding those regulations. What positive light do you see happening here in the States on efforts of coming together and really figuring out a lot of these paths that we have towards solutions of our future?
Yeah, I think where it can be positive, I mean, everyone has a role to play in a circular economy. If you look at a true circular economy, it cannot happen without regulations. It cannot happen without businesses, and it cannot happen without partnerships and different players in that space. So I think really regulations have a role to play in that and setting the level playing field. So if you have a federal law around EPRs, that sets a really level playing field for any industry that's trying to do business in the States. We know what we need to do. It's clear, you know, you can actually implement it and it will have actual tangible impacts. That's, I think, best case scenario. Unfortunately, what we see, though, is this patchwork system coming out with the different state regulations. Each one is regulating different products. So they have different products in scope. Sometimes it's furniture, sometimes it's not. They're setting different thresholds of sales. There's different costs. There's different EPR systems in place. So some, again, may not even, your money, once you're submitting that money into the EPR program, it may not ever get back to the recyclers and the infrastructure that actually need the money to ensure that that product is getting recycled at end of life. So I think there's a lot of barriers there that are just not working well. And like I said, you can learn from what's happening in Europe right now. And that's what we're kind of seeing is like that money is going in from the OEMs like Steelcase, we're paying into these systems, but is it really actually going towards the infrastructure that's needed in order to support the recycling of products?
I mean this in the best context. I think what you're saying too is there's a regionality to determining some of these regulations outside or within a federal mandate of some sort. I think it's always so interesting to me when you talk about the certain power dynamics within those regions. And so it's actually, I think of Michigan as such an innovative state when it comes to a lot of these initiatives. We at Reapley, we're working with a lot of similar contacts that you all might have at Steelcase. But it's so interesting how that identity in Michigan has formed towards a lot of these initiatives and pushing these initiatives. What can you say about that within Michigan? I've always been fascinated by seeing a lot of these innovative type of solutions, but then also really sticking by legacy solutions like a bottle bill. What can you say about the identity within Michigan that you feel being a native?
Yeah, I've worked a lot with the state on what they're trying to do and initiatives around recycled content, initiatives around reuse and circular economy. So I think the state really does care about these issues. They want to be kind of leading the charge in that sense. And then we also, from a furniture perspective, obviously have a lot of furniture industry here in the Grand Rapids area in particular, but Michigan in general. So I think there's a lot of interest around exploring what reuse looks like. You know, we have Kent County landfill right now, reimagining what a landfill looks like, and potentially putting a system in place where they could capture that value at the end of life and reuse it in some fashion, either through, taking the plastics out and reusing it or you know, really innovative strategies around like burning the material to a point where it could be used as a filler for plastics. There's all sorts of really cool exploration going on with the Kent County landfill. So I think it's interesting Michigan is taking a lead there. We also have very low recycling rates. If you look at it from, you know, a state perspective, we're one of the lowest in the country. So I think Michigan is taking, you know, the lead on, hey, we don't want to be the lowest. Yeah. We want to do what's right. I think a lot of it does come down to like politics and tipping fees and such though. So as long as tipping fees are low and landfill is still the least expensive option, that's going to be where products end up. And so I think ultimately Michigan is trying to look at that differently and see how they can incentivize more recycled content, which would eventually drive that recycling infrastructure and that recycling economy. I think they're exploring EPRs. We're not sure where they're going to go yet with that, but I think there's definitely some really innovative thinkers in this at the state level that are kind of driving change, and that, and there's funding there too, which is, you know, always good to see.
Always good to see. What, you know, I wanted to call this out. I love there's usually so many economics at play here when it comes to landfills or those tipping fees. One thing that's always fascinating is Michigan kind of makes sense though, because y'all have a lot of space. And so when there's so much space, a lot of land, the land is cheaper, which means the tipping fees are cheaper, which means it's easier to put things in landfill. And so that's always such a dynamic that I think people forget when it comes down to almost the simplicity of those economics sometimes. Where does Steelcase fall in this? What's the vision? I mean, you know, y'all have been creating great furniture for a long time. In Reapley's business, we see the aspects of that great builds that you all have. So there's obviously care and intentionality in the design and in the manufacturing. How do you all treat those products? What is your sort of the sustainability strategy? What's the circular economy strategy involved with sort of the future of Steelcase?
Well, I think we're on a journey, and I think, you know, all of the OEMs are on a journey right now to really explore what does that look like for us. We obviously build products that last a really long time. There's a ton of Steelcase furniture on the resale market, so we know that they last a long time. We will continue to build products that way. They have one of the longest extended warranties on the market. So that's always kind of been built into what we do. But I think what we're exploring now is what does it look like for us to help customers keep our products out of landfill? And when we do that, what we're finding is it's not just keeping our products out of landfill, we're keeping competitor products out of landfill as well. So I think there's a lot to explore from an OEM perspective. And I think what would be really interesting and exciting, and this is kind of space I would like to explore more, is how does that work from an OEM perspective, where we're coming together and working towards an end goal where, you know, we're not competing against who can send the most to landfill. So we all have similar issues, and there's similar scalability problems and regionality issues. So how could we potentially come together as OEMs and explore what does that look like for us to support? Maybe it is an EPR program. Maybe it's something where we're all funding and investing in end of life opportunities for customers so that we're supporting that circularity, working with you guys, working with partners to pilot and explore what does it look like to reuse Steelcase furniture. I think there's so much to explore there, and we're really just kind of on the cutting edge of a lot of that. But we've had some really great partnerships recently with Green Standards and others, where we're really trying to keep products out of landfill and have a high diversion rate there. But not only that, it's also helping with local communities. So when those pieces get donated in local communities, you're able to tell those stories of the beneficiaries. And so it's helping that beneficiary not have to worry about how they're going to find seats for their people. So there's some social aspects there too. And I think that's kind of the interesting part of a circular economy for me, is not just thinking about landfill diversion and waste. It's about the whole story. How do you upskill local communities to be makers and refinishers? Yes. Because I think that's really where this is going to have to head. It doesn't make sense for a customer in San Francisco to send 1,000 chairs back to Grand Rapids to be refurbished or remanufactured. It makes more sense for a local maker in that area to do that. And I think no OEM is going to be able to solve for that on their own. Right. So how do we work together to build that network of these makers and local skills that can help with that refurbishment piece? Because I think that's a huge missing link right now for any refurbishment or repair.
It takes it back almost to probably the origins of Steelcase. Again, of, you know, being so, I mean, I know the brand from being in the space of being so rooted in the community, that there's an element of taking it back to that place, of rooting it in the next generation of that furniture, rooting it in not necessarily expanding the footprint, but really ultimately investing in communities too that can help grow the brand, help continue the value of that furniture.
Yeah, we want to leave the communities in which we live, work, and play a better space. In the end, that's our value proposition. Yep. And I think that's something we really do believe down in our core. And it's something we try to live out. I mean, obviously, there's challenges here, like we talked about a couple of them. But, you know, you have reverse logistics challenges. You have the logistics challenge of, does it make sense from a sustainability perspective
to be shipping products all over? Yeah, from the footprint. Like,
what's the lesser evil there? And I think that's the challenge with sustainability, is there's always trade-offs. You're always choosing one thing over the other, and it's not always the best option. And that, I think, plays out a lot in the circular economy and maybe doesn't get discussed as much. But there's so many challenges and barriers to entry there that I think, and that's why I always say we're on this journey. I don't think it's appropriate that anyone has this all figured out, because they don't. And that, to me, that's a huge red flag if someone says that.
Yeah, no kidding.
We're definitely on a journey.
I think that's absolutely true. I've engaged with certain organizations in the sustainability world, in the circular economy world. The number one red flag might be like, oh no, we've got it figured out. And it's like,
I don't know
if y'all got it figured out. There's a humbleness coming, because the problems are so big.
I was going to say, not at scale, right? Like, you can see this working and playing out really well in local communities. And we see that in San Francisco. There's a ton of really cool partners there that are playing out circular economy models at a small scale. But once you start growing to a global scale, I do not know of a single partner or competitor that is doing this on a global scale. It's very challenging. There's so many logistics challenges.
Yes, absolutely. So speaking into those systems, what inspires you most about being in the sustainability world and solving? I think you as in your introduction, you said, I came from an interesting path. I think we in this industry, we all come from those paths. It's definitely an industry of like many people coming and bringing their different perspective. What inspires you most about the work that you're doing today? And then again, the people that it puts you in contact with of, you know, if we could get one more person in the field, what would you say to them, I guess?
I think it's such a cool field to be in right now. I never thought I'd see a day where sustainability was growing at the rate that it is right now. I mean, ESG is really kind of tipping it on its edge there and pushing it off the cliff. And I think that's exciting. What I think inspires me on a daily basis is, like I said, the change from within. And I mean, you could look at that another way, right? Like, you're almost corrupting for the good from within, and you have this power to really make a difference and change from within a corporation that without me in this position, I don't know if that would be happening, right? So I think that's exciting, but it also yields a lot of power. And so I think that's exciting. I'm excited always by, and we talk about this a lot, you and I, about how do we marry sustainability and profitability? I don't think those two have to be mutually exclusive of each other. I think
polar opposites. It's possible. Yeah,
I think it's totally possible. And I've seen that play out in my career quite a bit on, you know, taking plastic wrap at Steelcase that was waste. It was going to landfill. Taking that, and just by changing the system, and it was a lot of work to change that system and how it was being managed. But once we did that, we were able to take it, bale it, and send it to an end party that was able to reuse that material for a feedstock for a new product. Those are small little examples of circular economy playing out, but that was a profitable model for us. We were getting money back from it, whereas we were paying for it.
Yeah, can I have you unpack that a little bit? I think so many times we even get caught with either newer colleagues or people that are joining the field. They can get caught in this paralysis of scale ideas when there's so much power that can be
analysis
done.
Analysis paralysis.
Well, yeah, exactly. The classic. But I think even there, it's like people think, oh my God, all these systems and problems are insurmountable. And they're not. You got to break them down. And even in that little unique scenario, which you said, you figured out that there was some packaging and opportunity in the packaging to find some circularity. Can you break that down a little bit further in terms of the team and how did you guys work on that as a team? And what was that like in terms of identifying the problem, identifying the solution, and then making the change happen?
Yeah, I mean, it kind of always works backwards, right? We found out that on the recycling market, this product has a value if it's consolidated and baled and shipped directly to the end user. So that we kind of worked back from that. Like, we found that out and then did some engagement with that vendor and said, hey, we have this material. If we were able to get it consolidated in this way, would you be interested? And how much would you be willing to pay us for it? And negotiated that. And then the hard work comes in. And I think this is kind of where, you know, like you were saying, you get paralyzed by scale. Well, really, any pilot, you have to start small. And it does come down to like boots on the ground, hard work of saying, hey, we're going to do this and it's going to be hard and there's going to be labor involved in doing it, but it's worth it in the end. Here's the ROI. And so taking those actual financial calculations and proving that out to leadership and getting their buy-in and support, and then going boots on the ground and working with the teams and explaining and training and showing them how we have to bag this and put it in a baler in this way, and this is how you put it on the trailer, it can have skids, all this stuff. So it's probably a very complex process on the ground, but then we get a rebate for that material. So it's worth it in the end, and the ROI did make sense.
And none of that was without pain, I'm sure. I'm sure there were question marks at all turns. Right, and so it's like, again, that's a part of the process, and it's almost an embracing of that process a little bit. I was asked about, what does it mean to be like a circular disruptor in that way? And that's not to toot our own horn. I think we all are. But for me, the way I was just thinking about it, maybe it was that day, maybe it was that hour. For me, it was thinking about it in terms of, we have to provide so much friction to the status quo system that ultimately that system stops and then starts to reverse in another, maybe better direction. Again, corrupting, as you put it, that maybe that inefficiency. Or it was efficient for one way of thinking, but now we can build an efficiency in a way, in another way of thinking that ultimately builds in profitability. And I think that friction is just a part of the process. The pain is a part of that process.
Even on the smaller scale, like just starting to question things, like, does this make sense? Does it make sense to continue to, in the plastic wrap example, continue to throw that away at a cost, or does it make sense to reconfigure it in a way that, it takes some time, but once you get that system running, it's a smooth system and you're making money off that. That makes more sense. Yes. So I think just kind of breaking that down, like you're saying, you know, not getting caught up in the scale. I think a lot of people get caught up in the scaling on a circular economy. We were talking about this earlier today. Like, people just jump to the end state of like, wouldn't this be cool? And it's like, but in order to get there, you got to figure this out and this out and this out and that out.
Yes.
So there's so much in between that needs to work out. And it's completely dependent on partnerships between us and you and others. Those partnerships are going to be what makes this work in the end.
Yes. I love that we're, again, it's all about solving the mystery, asking the question, and then again, continuing to sort of, again, demystify a lot of the weird parts of all of this. And then we start to just solve one part at a time.
Failing forward. Not being afraid to fail, because you're going to learn more from the failures than you do from the successes. Like in that example I gave, I hate to keep going back to that, but we learned so much from the failure that we were able to scale it to all of our plants, because we knew, okay, this worked, this didn't work. When we move to another plant, this is what we're going to do differently. And that's how you really get around that scaling paralysis, is just by learning small and failing small so that it's not as painful. And then when you go to scale it, you know exactly what's going to work and what's not going to work.
Fail and tweak and fail and tweak. It's just refinement. Yes, I love that. I think that's so helpful for maybe even the growing audience or growing even demographics that are coming into sustainability and seeing it, to know that that's, again, a part of the process. And I love that you brought up failing, because you cannot be afraid of that. If you're afraid of failing, sustainability won't be necessarily the field for you.
Yeah.
Yes.
I heard a quote one time. It was like, I stood on a mountain of no's for one yes. And that is literally... Yes. Being in the sustainability profession,
yes.
You're going to get no, 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 no. And I think that to me has been the lesson, is finding those value added and profitability models that work, looking at the ROI, getting comfortable with calculating ROIs, because I think that's where you're going to get those yeses. And then when you can build up enough yeses, that's when you can kind of come in and say, hey, this may not be profitable, but it's the right thing to do. And so even in those cases, I've found there's profit to be found. So it's interesting. I think finding that good mesh of profitability and sustainability is something that I'm very passionate about.
I love that. Any last thoughts to leave our audience here on either the mountain of no's, the future of sustainability, the work that you love? What would you like to leave them with?
I think I'm super excited about the new, you know, flock of people that are coming in the sustainability world. I think they have a really good business acumen, which is really fun to see, because a lot of us, like me, you know, there was no sustainability degree when I was in college. It was like you get a undergrad in some environmental science degree and then you move into the sustainability world. And now what I'm seeing and working alongside a lot of colleagues, where they have that financial acumen, they have that business acumen, and so they're able to kind of hit the ground running in a way that I was not. So I'm really excited about that and where they're going to take us, because I think they're going to be able to solve for some of these problems that we're only starting to like open up,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
And it's those small tweaks that are going to make a big difference. But I really think this new flock of sustainability professionals are going to kind of push through some of those barriers. And then organizations like yourself, who are kind of pushing through some of those tech boundaries on, you know, how do we do this? What does this look like? How do we explore provenance of our products? I think that's exciting too. So that's kind of where I'm really focused on. I think just looking forward and learning from our past and, you know, exploring what that future looks like with the new generations.
I think you're exactly right. We're all standing on the shoulders of some other giant, and we can continue to do that. Thank you, Heidi. Thanks so much for taking the time today.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate it.